Okay, so we've shared a day of equanimity together, or at least exploring equanimity. I don't know how equanimous it's been in there for you, but maybe you have gotten a taste of the possibilities of bringing a balance, a centeredness to your experience and to yourself, to this mind, towards this body, towards life, and how powerful it is when we're not caught in our usual reactions to how life is treating us or not treating us. As I said, this is the precursor to the awakened mind. Remember all of those lists that equanimity is the culmination, the last of the factors to be developed before awakening, and the spaciousness that comes from not getting caught in our stories or in our feelings or in our reactions. And we've done a few different practices to explore that, remembering that in the moment that you're mindful, in every moment that you're mindful, that you're not grasping at the pleasant or pushing away the unpleasant or taking ownership of your experience. This is a moment of equanimity, that you're actually cultivating that attitude in every moment of mindfulness. Then we took a look at pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, seeing if we can simply notice that without those reactions, and how powerful it is to just know this experience for what it is. Oh, this is a pleasant moment, or this is an unpleasant moment, or a neutral moment. That you can practice that in your life. It's not just a good idea or waiting for your next retreat, that in the moment you remember to see things that way, there's some freedom. And then in that last meditation, that big mind meditation, that you can see the possibility of being the space of awareness, one way to think of it, that there is an awareness that can be the space in which everything rises and passes. I'm curious, how many people found that an interesting or useful perspective? Oh, good. Good. And if you didn't, that's absolutely fine. Sometimes people don't connect with it and say, oh, this is driving me crazy, or I just was falling asleep or whatever. So whatever your experience is absolutely fine. But all of the hands that went up, I'm so glad. I didn't know if I was going to do it, but it just felt right to do, to just give that spaciousness that we've been talking about right into your practice. And you can bring that into your practice at any time. If you're feeling a little bit tight, just sense being the space of awareness in which things are coming and going on their own. Equanimity takes courage. You might think that, it seems like like you're not reacting and it's cool, everything is okay. But actually, and I didn't mention this before, the near enemy of equanimity, what looks like equanimity, but is actually very different, is indifference. Is apathy. Like, I don't care. It's all right. Doesn't matter. Whatever. You know that. Whatever is not the most spiritual response. As equanimous as it might sound, whatever, but it's really whatever. I'll tolerate this, but boy, if I were running the show, I'd paint a different picture. Whatever is a near enemy, it looks like equanimity, but there's a distancing, a not caring. Equanimity, you're still caring, but there's a spaciousness that allows things to be the way they are. And that's where, you know, I mentioned in the Brahma Viharas that equanimity holds the others, particularly around compassion. You know, we can see suffering around us, and our hearts can go out in feeling that suffering, whether it's somebody close to us or somebody far away, or you read about some real sad story in the news, or something that you might be affected as I have been in recent years, reading about climate change and how scary that is and what humanity is doing, and your heart can break. And you can say, how can I hold this all? And this is where equanimity comes in, where, yes, this is hard, this is difficult, this is painful, but you are not drowning in that opening to the suffering. The heart is here, it cares, and the equanimity gives the spaciousness to see, and this is how things are right now, and how can I respond in a way that's skillful? T.S. Eliot, in the Four Quartets, he has this beautiful line. He says, teach us to care and not to care. And both of them are important. To care, but to not care so much that we feel overwhelmed, but to have enough space so that our caring can be effective and we can act out of love rather than frustration and anger or deep sorrow. And this is the power of equanimity. And as I said, equanimity is seeing the bigger picture, the biggest picture. The Dalai Lama says, talking about how humanity is doing all kinds of crazy things and climate change, and he says, you know, world systems come and they go. World systems will come and go. Who knows if this civilization and humanity is going to be lasting? This might be just the most current experiment of life. And it might not last. But to know that you've done everything you can to bring about more consciousness and caring in the world, that's all you can do. And I'm very much in, not just in favor, but inspired by people whose practice can be a gift in their caring about the planet and about life. But to have that equanimity hold your actions brings about a whole other quality that's very magnetizing to others. To see what really moves you. I love a line by Andrew Harvey, who wrote a beautiful book called The Hope, A Guide to Sacred Activism, where he says, follow your heartbreak. Follow where your heart is breaking, because that's the place that is disturbing you, and put your love into action. another teacher, Angelus Arian, says, action absorbs anxiety that we feel somewhat relieved when we can express our caring, but to have it come from that place of seeing, this is how things are. This is the way it is. How can I respond with love? And as I said, it takes courage. It takes courage to open up to those places that hurt inside. It takes courage, and perhaps you saw it today as you were practicing, to be willing to open up to the places that get afraid inside, to the places that feel small, to the places that seem petty and not very spiritual, or opening up to our deep wants and obsessions and to see, oh yeah, this too is part of being human. So to really see that and to learn that you can work with it, this is really powerful. And as perhaps you've seen in practice, running away from those scary places doesn't put an end to the problem. In fact, it seems that they just follow us around. So we need to, if we can, find the courage and the skill and the support to turn towards all of those places that are difficult for us to face inside. This is a poem from a woman named Jennifer Wellwood. It's a beautiful poem called Unconditional. She says, willing to experience aloneness, I discover connection everywhere. Turning to face my fear, I meet the warrior who lives within. Opening to my loss, I gain the embrace of the universe. Surrendering into emptiness, I find fullness without end. Each condition I flee from pursues me. Each condition I welcome transforms me and becomes itself transformed into its radiant jewel-like essence. I bow to the one who has made it so, who has crafted this master game. To play it is pure delight. To honor its form, true devotion. And this is where the courage of equanimity comes in, to face the most difficult things and see we will survive. A little at a time, what I often like to call titrating our dukkha. You know that word, titrating, like in homeopathy. A little at a time. You just touch it a little at a time. Touch our suffering a little at a time until you become more and more able to face the hardest stuff. And that requires this spaciousness that says, yes, this is how it is right now. This is how things are, and I can be with it too. So it takes courage to be here for the whole show. And it also takes courage to see how you get and how we get attached to things wanting being a certain way, and when you see it and it seems, oh my goodness, I can't believe I get so caught in that wanting, and there you are having practiced meditation or Dharma for a while, and this came up in some of the groups, and saying, you know, I can't believe I'm in this place again. You know, I thought I was a more spiritual person to not get caught anymore. This is humbling. It's a very humbling thing to see, oh yeah, there I am caught again, and I want to acknowledge there's a price to pay for becoming more aware. And that is, you can't pretend you don't see it. You can't pretend you don't see the ways that you get caught. And you might think, gosh, I was better off before I got into this whole stuff, you know. Who needs this? Oh my goodness, there's all this fear, and there's all this yuck, and there's all this pettiness, and there's all this whatever. Don't get caught in thinking, now that I see where the truth is, I should know better and not get caught anymore. This just compounds the problem. This is what in the Buddhist teachings is called adding a second arrow on top of the first. The first one, getting caught, is painful enough, but then judging yourself for getting caught is a second arrow and a whole quiver of arrows. Oh yeah, got caught again. But rather than that, to see, oh, this is what it means to be human. I mentioned in the group's a Pema Chodron line that I really love. She says, take delight in that which sees the dukkha. Instead of feeling so lousy, oh, there's dukkha again and I'm just caught again, she says, take delight, appreciate that there's an awareness that is seeing the dukkha. It's a little shift that makes all the difference, that emphasis. And that equanimity is just saying, oh, this is how things are. This is the way it is. It's okay, because now I can learn more from it. In fact, one basic understanding of karma, you might think that doing something unskillfully and not realizing it's unskillful is better than doing something unskillfully and knowing you're doing it unskillfully. But actually, that's not so. From the standpoint of waking up, doing something unskillfully and knowing that it's unskillful, as painful as that is better than not having a clue. Because if you don't have a clue, you're bound to keep on repeating it. But if you take a look and you see, ooh, this is not so skillful, and you can let yourself feel the pain of it, you see, ooh, this is how it feels when I do this. And so from a karmic point of view, it's better to be humbled in your spiritual confusion than to not have a clue. And this, again, calls for equanimity that says, yeah, this is the way it is. This is how I get attached. This is how I get confused. So let me just ask before I go on, for you to reflect for a moment. Just go inside for a moment. And get in touch with where you get attached. What do you have strong investment in? And where do you get thrown off balance? And what could you remember in your wisest moments to let go of the pain of attachment and develop balance and equanimity. In your wisest moments, what can you remember? Okay, you can open your eyes. I'm just curious before I give any further response. How could you remember to let go of your attachments and confusions? Anything that helps you to see through it and loosen your attachments a bit? Yeah, Bernard.
Breathing.
Okay, breathing, getting some space. That's one way to just get some space and not get so contracted. Yes. Anything else? There might be a number of answers.
Becoming a feeling, usually it's bodily tension there. Just feeling that tension.
Mm. So be... Mm-hmm. Being willing to feel the pain of the attachment and the tension. Yeah, very good. Anything else that you could remember or remind yourself? Yes.
This is how things are, and I cannot control them.
This is how things are, and I don't have control over them. Is that what you said? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I can't control this. Okay. But anything else? John?
Just letting it go and mindfully attending to something else.
Okay, turning your awareness to something else so you're not just keeping on re-stimulating this. Yeah, you don't have to keep on re-traumatizing yourself. Mm-hmm. Anything else? What's that?
Forgiving
yourself, yes. Beautiful. Anything else? Just realizing this is a mental fabrication. This is just a thought that's come in the mind. Yes, that you don't have to believe. Yes.
If nothing else works, talking to a good friend.
Talking to the pain.
Yes.
Yes, and just.
Talking to another person.
Like a good friend. Oh, yeah. Sure, having the support that you need to give you some space. Yes.
I read a book from some teacher or blog post from somewhere.
Finding some inspiration in a book or a talk or a teacher. Yes. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Suppose you're really attached to something. Any other reflection that hasn't been named so far? All of these are really fine, so I'm not looking for the right answer. These are all excellent, excellent answers. Yes?
Kind of reflecting what's the intention behind it. There's some meaning.
Okay, what's the intention behind it? Yes?
If there is a dearest dream or the dearest wish.
If there is what?
If there is a very dearest dream or wish in your heart.
Ah, what's the...
Is this serving?
Ah, like yesterday with our intention. Is this serving my highest intention? Yeah, lovely. Anything else? Well, one thing also that I haven't mentioned so far that's really a very key principle in equanimity is understanding, as we said at the beginning of the day, the ups and downs and ups and downs, reflecting on impermanence. However things are right now, however obsessed you are about things going a certain way, it's going to change. Whatever you're attached to now, reflecting on impermanence, you will see this is not going to last. It's something that you have been, that life has been showing you your whole life. When you think about it, for instance, people who've been very close to you, your best friends. Think of your best friend right now, and it's wonderful to have friends. Okay, think of you now, your best friend, your very first best friend, when you were a little child. Okay, how precious that was, right? How many people, and there can be a number of people here, how many people have the same best friend that was their first best friend, is their best friend right now? It happens from time to time. One, two, three people that your best friend was your original best friend. A whole lot of other people, your best friends have changed. Now, while you had your best friend, the thought of them not being your best friend anymore, that would have probably been very painful. Oh no, we're not going to be best friends? I don't think I could survive. How many best friends have you had? So, the good news about impermanence is not that there's just a vacuum there and nothing takes its place. It's there's something continually new about life. And things change. Think of how many crushes you've had in your life. You know? Who's with their very first crush? Sometimes it happens. Often it doesn't. Yeah. The one that you said, oh no, I'll die if I'm not with them. How many crushes have you had in your life? And you've survived each one. This is another aspect of equanimity. That things change. And the Buddha talked specifically about remembering every day what he called the five reflections. I am of the nature to become old. I will become old. I am of the nature to become sick. This body will become sick. I am of the nature to die. This body will die. Everything and everyone near and dear to me, I will be separated from. Everything and everyone near and dear to me, I will be separated from. And I am the owner of my karma. My actions are the cause of my unhappiness and happiness. He said, think about these things every day, not to bum yourself out, not to depress yourself, but to see, oh, this is how things are. Because as you can allow for the unfolding of karma to unfold in its own way, you start to loosen your control over things, as was said over here. And it's this control, this attachment, that really is the cause of our suffering. That's where the Buddha said, the second noble truth, attachment to our desires. The third noble truth, freedom, letting go of that attachment. Opening to the highest kind of freedom, complete letting go. And this means letting go of the control that you never had in the first place. So equanimity practice, one very powerful component of equanimity practice is seeing that things are really out of our control. We have some say, certainly practicing mindfulness and practicing loving kindness and cultivating wholesome states and learning to be more compassionate and being more conscious, that faces us in the right direction, like we talked about yesterday. But as far as our control in our life in any one moment, we have very limited control. What we do have control in is how we can relate to the moment, that we can cultivate. But to let go of our control and see how life is unfolding and be here for the karmic unfolding, this is a tremendous release. And this is where equanimity comes in, and just saying, ah, and this is how things are. Or as Ajahn Sumedho, who I read from yesterday, I think, said, it's like this. That's the basic equanimity perspective. It's like this. I want to share with you the classic, I didn't do this yet, the classic equanimity practice that one cultivates in intensive practice. The equanimity practice that sees that we don't have control over our own lives or others' lives. The classic practice is, it's a little bit wordy, but this is the one usual translation. You are the owner of your karma. Your happiness and unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. Particularly when we have a strong investment in how others are, or how we hope they'll be, or our loved ones, and if we could only fix them, if we could only rescue them from their pain or sorrow, then we'd be feeling much more relaxed. But we don't have control. And you say that to yourself too. I am the owner of my karma. My happiness and unhappiness depends on my actions, not only on my wishes for myself. So I'll share with you a story about my own practice with equanimity. I was in a longer retreat practicing Brahma-viharas, the loving kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity. And I got to this equanimity practice. This is after several weeks of sitting. And when I first heard it, it sounded a little distant and cool. You're the owner of your karma. Your happiness and unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. But then I started to get it. Oh, how freeing. I don't have to save everybody. I can't anyway. And so I started to get very excited about it. Oh, that's how it works. I can let go of being the savior for anybody and everybody. I can care, but I can let go of being the savior. And I had this one meditation, very memorable meditation, where I put different people in that seat of telling them. And I put Jane in that seat, and and it was just telling her the good news. Ah, you're the owner of your karma. Your happiness and happiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. And wishing her the best, but really letting go of thinking that I have control over it. And it felt really good. And then I put some other people in there, and my friends in there, and my teachers in there. And then my son appeared in that seat. And at the time, my son was 10 years old. And all of a sudden, it had a different feel to it. As I said to him, you are the owner of your karma. My happiness, your happiness and unhappiness depends on your actions, not on my wishes for you. And I then had the most one of the most memorable sittings in my life. I called it, I write about this in Awakening Joy, I called it my Clockwork Orange sitting. If you've ever seen the movie Clockwork Orange, which is a really intense movie, they're kind of deprogramming this guy and showing him one horrible image after another to kind of brainwash him. And there was my son as I said this, and I thought of him being in an auto accident and being disfigured and killed. I thought of him being a drug addict, and I thought of him running around with the wrong people, and I thought one after another I had these awful scenes, and each one I'd say the equanimity meditation, and it was, oh, your happiness and unhappiness depends on your actions. And little by little, I spent about, it was a good hour or more, just with these awful scenes in my mind. And it was a turning point for me in my relationship with him, because after a while I got, as much as I cared about him, I couldn't prevent him from having the lessons that he needed to have in this lifetime. And after a while, that whole long statement became, I honor your journey. You will need, you will get the lessons that you need. I honor your life's journey. And this is the real power of equanimity, to just honor how things are and realize you get all the lessons that you need. Think of all the things that have happened to you in this lifetime. Some of them probably really hard lessons, but they've all gone into you learning just what you've needed to learn. And when I look back on my life, there have been some really difficult things and some really beautiful things. And now I wouldn't change anything, because in the difficult things we learn compassion, and in the beautiful things we learn appreciation and joy. And it's interesting that we get just the life curriculum that we need. If we can see it with equanimity and see this unfolding of karma leads just what we need to learn, then we can start to trust in life and surrender our thinking that we need to have control or know it all. And we can trust that life will support us if we let it. How amazing it is. Albert Einstein said that perhaps the most important question a human being could ask themselves is the universe friendly or not? And if you see it as unfriendly, it will be unfriendly. But if you see it as friendly, it will, in general, more likely support you, even with the difficult stuff that you go through. It's all part of your curriculum. And no matter how difficult it's been, everything in your life has led you up to this day of practicing and sharing the Dharma together. There must be something really good happening in your life, because this is quite good karma that we all share to want to wake up, to want to open our hearts, and to be in this situation where we can share with other like-minded people. To be in a human body is quite extraordinary. That everything, even stronger than your doubts and your fears and your confusions, something has pulled you through to bring you to this moment and given you just the lessons that you've needed to. This is trusting that things are unfolding just as they need to, if you can wisely open to your curriculum. What a wonderful way to go through your life. And this means letting go of figuring out, letting go of your agenda, having a vision like we talked about yesterday, an inspiring vision, but then you doing your part and then letting life support you. This is the power of equanimity that trusts and can surrender, that trusts that your awareness will meet the moment when it's here. Not in figuring out how I can win at the game, but trusting that what you need will appear, and your own good heart, if you can listen carefully enough, will keep on guiding you. So this is the power of equanimity to bring about a spaciousness so you can really hear the wisdom that's right inside and really trust in life and see that everything is part of your journey. So I think I'll stop here and see some questions. Sharing. Yes?
You said about getting just the lessons you need in life. I can understand that it's a very positive way to look at your life. Mm-hmm. Looking it that way makes it more fruitful than rather than being bitter.
Yeah.
Still, as I told you earlier, I've been having a look at my own early experiences, mm-hmm. and also as I work with children, I definitely think that there are things that shouldn't happen to them, mm-hmm. and shouldn't happen to me either.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Do you understand what I mean?
Yes, I do, and it's a very good and important question, and so. Just for the purposes of the recorder, getting the lessons that you need, it's a positive way to see things, but there are some things that are awful that happen to us and that, as she says, shouldn't have happened, or she's working with children and shouldn't happen to those children. And what you're saying is really important and true, and I really want to honor and respect. And what I can say as far as karma goes, it's a very mysterious thing. And the Buddha said that it's one of the things that you can... It's one of the four things that can drive you crazy trying to understand and figure out. So this is very complex. And one way to think of this is more than one lifetime, because he does say we have been doing this for countless eons. All the bones in our incarnations are higher than the highest mountain, or the tears that we've shed are greater than the four oceans. So, to see that we have been on this journey for many lifetimes gives a bit of perspective in that. And the way that karma works, and I'm glad you bring this up, or one way to hold karma is not to look in hindsight and say, what did I do to deserve this? Because it's very easy for karma to just be another way to feel either guilty or bad, or I must have done something wrong or to deserve this. But rather that where you are now can be used as a vehicle for awakening. And just as you were sharing in the group, and in a very beautiful way, that you're learning lessons, you're learning what I heard, you're learning to hold things with compassion in a way that that perhaps is very profound. And it doesn't excuse what happened to you in the past, but here you are deepening your compassion and able to be there with those children, perhaps in a very different way than most people. And perhaps those children will learn, especially having received your own caring and compassion, to hold their own pain and feel the pain of the world and be a source of compassion for others. So in looking at karma, not to look in the past and say, why did this happen, but to, if we're lucky enough to have teachings that can hold it, how can I use what has happened to me so that I can deepen my understanding and compassion? And that's how I hold it. Thank you. Did you have your question from before?
Yeah. I mean, my dilemma is that if you're like, you're being mindful in the situation and you're kind of understanding it without being grasped by the feelings.
Mm.
So the dilemma is that could you be understood that you are kind of feeling less or emotionless?
Uh-huh. So if you're holding the feelings with mindfulness, can they be understood and expressed? Yeah.
I think I understand.
Yeah, please. Yeah, please.
That you could be misunderstood for not having.
For not having feelings.
Because you're holding them with
mindfulness. I see. If you get to the place where all your feelings have evaporated and you're truly at peace, people will be following you as the next avatar, probably. You don't want to be bypassing your feelings. In fact, you feel everything. You feel things very deeply. But as far as acting on the feelings wisely and communicating the feelings, you know, as Jane will tell you, I can get very intense about things. You know, when I first started getting into meditation, I'm a huge sports fan, and I went to my teacher this very first summer, and I said, I'm a season ticket holder to the big sports team in Madison Square Garden, the New York Knicks. Am I going to go to the basketball game and say, oh, very nice shot, you know, oh, that's a good pass, for, you know. And he said, no, you're still going to, you'll probably still feel intense over your team, which my team won this year, and I'm actually wearing my shirt of my team here. This is, this is the Golden State Warriors, you know. He said, you'll still feel passionate, but you'll probably get over a loss sooner. I said, okay, I'm in. You'll feel all the feelings, but hopefully with mindfulness, you'll be able to process them first inside so that the expression doesn't come out that creates more suffering than is useful. I'm very much in favor of feeling passionately about things and caring as much as you can about the planet, for instance. Or if somebody is doing something that is unskillful, to be able to skillfully say, this is not right. But if you're coming from hatred. As the Buddha said, hatred does not cease by hatred. Hatred ceases by love alone. Rather than coming from hatred, if you come from clarity and strong intention and alignment in the truth and what's called fierce compassion that sees that the real villain is ignorance, not that evil, they're just not seeing clearly, then you can be that much more effective in your actions. Or if you're feeling angry, to say to somebody, I'm feeling really angry now, but to have the intention, I'm feeling really angry, and I want to have as skillful a communication as possible with you, and I need to talk about something. If you can communicate that, it's different than somebody saying, as we sometimes say in California, are you ready for some feedback? No. They're probably not going to say, oh yeah, lay it on me, right? But if you say, there's something that's getting in the way, and I really value our relationship and want to have as good a communication as we can, and when you're ready, I would love to be able to talk about this with you, you might be a little bit more ready to hear, because you can hear the underlying intention. That comes from mindfulness. That comes from saying, wow, this really hurts, and underneath the anger is this hurt, and I really need to express this. There's a little bit more possibility of being understood. So it's feeling everything you do and feeling alive and not suppressing, because when you suppress, it's going to come back in other ways anyway. But when you can process your genuine feelings and process them wisely and feel the hurt part or the sad part or the frightened part and say, this is what's happening and I want to communicate it wisely, that takes mindfulness and you've got a lot better chance of being understood. Okay, so it's time to go. I just first want to say just how much I appreciated practicing with you these 2 days. I could really feel the sincerity of the group and so much appreciated the group interviews, and I know that Jane and Sari and John appreciated meeting with you individually. And I want to say again about using the resources here of Sari and Anna if you want to check in about your practice. John is a busy guy and he's got a lot of other things to do, although I'm sure he'd be available if you wanted to meet with him. And using Naroda and what the community has created here. Oh, and I want to say that next year we've actually already set a date, and Jane and I will be back here next year, and instead of doing just a day long or a couple of day longs, we will be doing a week long retreat, a full on intensive retreat here in Helsinki in July, the second half of July, like the 15th or 16th or something like that, 16th to the 24th. And it'll be great if to sit with you again. Let's see, what else? And I do encourage you in these next days to, if you were here for both days, to work with intention and to work with equanimity in your practice. You can incline your mind and invite balance. May I have balance in my life? And just call on it, and you might have more likelihood for it to be here. And also, lastly, just see that you're practicing not just for yourself, but when you practice, you're bringing a bit more consciousness and caring and compassion into the world, and everybody becomes the beneficiary of your practice. So let it be a gift to everyone. Maybe we can just close with a dedication. So just feel the wholesomeness of these last couple of days that you've given to yourself and to everybody in your life, and wish yourself well. May I open to as much kindness and wisdom as I can in my life and in my heart. And may I share my love well. May I know the highest happiness and peace. And extending that to everyone here, may all of us be supported in our practice. May we see all the goodness inside and share it well. And know the highest happiness and peace. And then extending to outward to all beings, may all see their true nature. May all be free of suffering. May all know the highest happiness and peace. And may our coming here together and practicing together be of benefit to ourselves and ripple out to be of benefit to all beings everywhere.